We are creatures of desire. What we most desire is meaning. What makes us suffer most is a lack of meaning.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Marital therapist, author, and communications trainer Andrew G. Marshall invites guests from all walks of life to discuss what makes life meaningful.
Hello, I'm Andrew G. Marshall. Welcome to The Meaningful Life. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Podbean, and wherever you find your podcasts. Today, I'm going to be discussing a topic steeped in secrecy and shame, but affects, according to estimates, about 1 in 20 people and makes up 25% of all search terms. Perhaps you've guessed already, but we're going to be talking about sex and pornography addiction. It's a controversial diagnosis for the general public, who think it is an excuse for bad behaviour, and amongst my profession too, who debate whether it is a compulsion rather than an addiction. I first met my witness over 15 years ago, when I took one of her training courses. Dr. Paula Hall is the founder of the Laurel Centre and a sexual and relationship psychotherapist who specialises in helping people impacted by sex and porn addiction. She's the author of 4 books in this field, including Sex Addiction, A Guide for Couples, and Understanding and Treating Sex and Pornography Addiction, A Comprehensive Guide for People Who Struggle with Sex Addiction and Those Who Want to Help Them. Her most recent venture is founding the not-for-profit organisation Pivotal Recovery to provide anonymous, accessible and professional help for people struggling with sex and porn addiction. So, Paula, how did you come into this field? Because I can't imagine you telling your careers officer at school, I want to help people with porn and sex addictions.
No, I wonder how that would have gone down. That would have been an interesting conversation, wouldn't it? No, well, I trained as a therapist initially, would you believe, 32 years ago. I always know how long ago it was, because it was actually when my first child was born, and I did what many women do, I retrained. And initially I worked on a drugs helpline, and I did that for a few years, and then I trained with Relate, became a couple counsellor, then I trained, did more training, became a sex therapist, by which time child number two was there. And then from there, I guess it was as a sex therapist that I started noticing people coming forward with compulsive sexual behaviours. And I guess that was about, well, if we met 15 years ago, that was probably about 20 years ago now that I started noticing this pattern. But we didn't really have any language for it. We didn't really have a label for it. And it was a dear friend and colleague, Thaddeus Burchard, who unfortunately has passed away since, who actually did a talk at a conference and started talking about sex and porn addiction. And it was just those light bulb moments. I was like, oh my goodness, this, all the things that I'd learned in terms of drug addiction, a lot of the stuff that I'd learned as a sex therapist, those two worlds then came together. And I thought, aha, aha, now I know what it is that I'm dealing with. Since then, I don't have to tell you, Andrew, the research has come on leaps and bounds. Can you believe it? When we met, we didn't really have smartphones. We would have had a little flip-top phone back then, texting like that, if indeed we had that. But of course, pornography has proliferated society since then, which means the problem has as well. And yeah, it's become everything I do, all the work that we specialise in.
So why is there so much controversy about the word addiction in this field?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I think it is changing. It is beginning to change, because now the problem is accepted in ICD, in the International Classification of Diseases. So it's kind of accepted as a problem. When I first started out, people were saying, this isn't an issue. This is a non-problem. You're making it up. People making excuses. It's people who can't, with a high libido, perhaps. Yeah, there was a lot of denial that there was an issue at all. That has changed considerably, particularly over the course of the last 5 or 6 years since it was included in ICD. Now it is widely accepted that this is a problem. Pornography use is very problematic, particularly for a lot of people. And for a lot of people, it escalates to offline sexual behaviours as well. So it's recognised as a problem, but there is still some misunderstandings on whether or not it's best described as an impulse control disorder, a compulsive disorder, or an addictive disorder.
Talk me through those three things.
So a compulsive disorder, think compulsive hand washing, checking whether your back door's locked over and over again. Is it locked? Is it locked? I must just check. That's a compulsive disorder. The reason it doesn't quite fit with compulsive disorder is that a compulsive disorder doesn't give pleasure. People don't wash their hands because they enjoy it or lock the back door multiple times because it's fun. Whereas initially, at least, people do engage in these sexual behaviours because there's pleasure associated. So there's no reward for compulsivity, which is why it doesn't quite fit there, although it has some characteristics. Impulse control disorder. So this is an impulse control disorder. I mean, at the moment, the other ones are kleptomania, so impulsive stealing, pyromania, impulsive setting of fires, and compulsive sexual behaviour disorder. It's hardly in a great category, really. The reason it doesn't really fit with that is because for a lot of people, it requires planning. A lot of people will be quite ritualised. They will decide that they are going to have a binge fest of pornography on Friday evening when their partner is out of the house and they have the house to themselves. That's not impulse control because it's planned ahead, it's ritualized, it's organized. Also, generally with impulse control disorders, they're not done to manage an emotional state. There's often other underlying issues, but it's not done as a form of affect regulation, whereas we know that addictive behaviors are. And many people with sex and porn addiction talk about how it's a way of managing stress, managing anxiety, managing feelings of loneliness or low self-esteem. So we know it's often about emotional regulation. So impulse control doesn't really fit. Addictive disorders, in many respects, it fits that better than anything else. But what we don't yet have evidence of, research evidence, we have clinical evidence, but not research evidence, is that there is actually escalation, that actually people move on and need more and more and more. So if you think of alcohol or drugs, we develop tolerance and we start needing more alcohol in order to feel drunk. So we get that escalation. And also when we withdraw from drugs or a chemical addiction, then we feel shaky. There are all sorts of side effects from withdrawal. So at the moment, we don't actually have any evidence of withdrawal or escalation, although saying that, all of that research is being done. But in many ways, gambling started as a compulsive disorder and is now recognised as an addictive disorder because it's recognised that the withdrawal tends to be much more psychological and emotional than physical. And also the escalation is around risk. So generally, people with a addictive disorder of gambling take more and more and more risks. They don't need more and more gambling per se, but they take more risks. And that is the way that we see escalation in sex and porn addiction as well. So at the moment, basically, the jury is still out. It's down as a compulsive disorder, it's down as an impulse control disorder in ICD. But the expectation of many professionals is that it will move to addictive disorders. But whatever the label, people are struggling and people need help. And I get a bit frustrated by some professionals who want to throw stones. The language the public use is always going to be addiction. There's no such thing as drug addiction. It's substance misuse disorder. But who goes around saying, oh, I know someone with substance misuse disorder? None of us do. We call it drug addiction.
So what you say is it's not the behaviour, but the dependency.
Exactly, exactly. And ultimately, the type of behaviour isn't really relevant. It's certainly relevant to partners, with my experience of working with partners. But if you think of alcohol dependency or any other type of addiction, it doesn't matter whether you prefer whiskey or sherry or prefer, you know, a pint of beer or whatever it is. It doesn't matter if your gambling is on the horses or on the football or on the slot machines. It's the dependency on how the behavior makes you feel that defines it as a problem rather than the actual type of behavior itself.
So sex and porn addiction go together. Is sex addiction an escalation from porn addiction?
There are some people who struggle with the term sex addiction because they say, but I've never had sex. It's only ever been pornography. But to me, it's a sexual behaviour addiction. pornography is definitely sexual. There's no doubt about that. So we know within sex addictions, pornography is the biggest problem. So problematic pornography use, researchers reckon, takes up about 75-80% of people. But often when we see people with porn addiction, it has escalated. It's escalated to chat, sexual chat. It's escalated to webcams. It might have escalated to being onto the hookup sites. The point at which it escalates to physical contact sex, maybe later on, or for some, never at all. But it's often escalates beyond pornography to the more interactive, real-time online behaviours.
Yes, because I've had clients where the female partner has sort of said, men and pornography, let them get on with it. But, she came in one day and found that he was actually talking to somebody. And this was somebody on a webcam who was, I assume from what she was saying, being paid to be flirtatious and show and do various bits and pieces. And somehow, for her, that crossed a line that was very different from just watching people who've been pre-recorded.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for many partners, the type of behaviour does make a difference. And of course, the type of pornography does make a difference as well. We know that some pornography can have really quite a negative impact on society, or for some parts of society, young people particularly, there's a whole load of stuff going on there. So the type of pornography might be an escalation, but often it's going into these sort of chat worlds. One of the things that's interesting to know is that about 80% of pornography is actually what they call clickbait. So it's actually free. Vast majority of pornography is free, but it's clickbait. So it's trying to get you to paid for services. They're not stupid. They're not offering this stuff for free, not really. They're trying to get you to the services that are paid for. So anybody that uses porn regularly will know that they are constantly being sent notifications or adverts or whatever all the time for other sexual services. So it's all about upping the ante into those paid for services, which tend to be the more interactive ones.
And what about love addiction, which is sort of being addicted to the thrill of romance? Is this something entirely different, or does this sort of fit into this category as well?
The people in the addiction world, people who've come from kind of a chemical addiction world, would say addiction is addiction is addiction. What they all have in common is working on the dopamine centers in the brain. There's some neurological similarities. From a psychological perspective, they're all about emotional regulation, escaping into fantasy, escaping into drugs, a way of numbing out something that is difficult and uncomfortable. And from a kind of social perspective, they're often about withdrawing from other people that we might have really good relationships with. They're about actually, withdrawing from real connection. And I think love addiction does that as well. So in many respects, across the board, it doesn't matter what it is. The difference, of course, with sex and porn addiction, and indeed love addiction, is that abstinence is not the ultimate goal. Nobody wants to give up sex. No one's going to die without sex, of course, but actually, some clients say, why would you want to live though? It's not about abstinence. And certainly in terms of love, it's not about abstinence, but it's about changing your relationship to your sexuality and changing your relationship to your attachment figures, to use the language that we would use in therapy.
So what I find whenever I'm dealing with addiction, which is not my speciality by any shape, but the reality is that you are often dealing with people who either are former addicts or have a problem with some kind of substance. And I think it's really helpful to understand what's going on in the brain. And actually, I use one of your videos. I send people off to watch your video, The Road to Brighton, which explains what goes on in the brain. And we will put the details of that in the show notes, but explain to us The Road to Brighton and why that helps us understand addiction and the brain. I should point out to people that we're talking about Brighton in the UK, which is a southern seaside town just to the south of London. So off you go, Paula.
And just to make it clear, I have nothing against Brighton. I'm actually from Brighton originally. It's my hometown. I spent lots of time there as an adolescent. It's a metaphor. So we don't want the Brighton Tourist Board getting in contact with you. So Brighton is, it's a lovely, lovely seaside town. It's a lovely place. It's very bright. There's lots of activities. There's lots of things going on there. It's got a real buzz to it. And of course, people in other countries would have their own places like that.
And it also has a reputation for being a bit of a wicked place as well. So it works quite well as a metaphor.
Yes, indeed. And actually maybe a bit, yeah, it's become a bit of one of those places for Hindus and stag doos as well, hasn't it? But a bit of a hedonistic place, perhaps, a place of pleasure. So if using that as a metaphor, what I do is I talk about Brighton as representing the addiction, and this can work with any type of addiction. So that represents the addiction, whether it's chemical, whether it's gambling, whether it's shopping, whether it's love, whether it's sex or porn. And if you think of London, so as you say, London is about, 50, 60 miles north, as being your normal life. Use that as a metaphor to represent your ordinary life. All of us enjoy pleasure. So if you go to Brighton, if you keep going to Brighton, what happens is we develop a neural pathway. So that's just basic learning neuroscience, that when you do something, you repeat a behavior on a regular basis, you build a neural pathway to it. If you go to your addiction, if you go to Brighton on a regular basis, that neural pathway becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. And unlike, for example, when you're learning to play the piano and you build a neural pathway, if you're building a neural pathway that is particularly pleasurable, that has a lot of dopamine, you're building a particularly rigid pathway. So over a period of time, that pathway becomes stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger, and it becomes almost automated. I often ask people what's the difference between an addiction and a habit and a bad habit? And to be honest, there isn't really that much difference, particularly from a neurological perspective. You're creating a habitual path. So very, very quickly, you can find yourself on the road to Brighton without giving it much thought at all. You get up in the morning, you brush your teeth, you sit down, you watch pornography, because that's what you do every morning after you've brushed your teeth. It becomes habituated and becomes a regular thing. So getting into recovery from a neuroscience perspective means you need to stop going to Brighton. And critically, you need to stop looking at pictures of Brighton and fantasizing about Brighton, because we know this a lot actually from sports psychology, interestingly. If you continue to fantasize or visualize something, we actually continue to strengthen that neural pathway. It's why visualization can be such a powerful tool for healing, because it can take us to a positive place. But actually, if you visualize or fantasize, as we'd use that term, in an addictive process, then actually it strengthens the neural pathway in a negative way.
And what's happening is you've got this motorway, the sort of almost like a 10 carriage motorway going straight to your pleasure place. And every other kind of pleasure is going to be really rather pathetic in comparison. And there's a feeling that if you give up your prime reward, your life is going to be complete and utterly meaningless. But there are other ways of getting to pleasure. It's just that effectively, they're now all blocked up. The little side roads and little byways have now got tractors going down them, and there's lots of dead ends. So you've sort of got to find new ways, effectively, not to Brighton, but to the south coast, shall we say. We're not going to Brighton, but we could go to Hastings or Eastbourne or one of these other more respectable places.
Indeed. And so many people sort of say, but none of these other places are as interesting as Brighton. Nowhere else is as exciting. And in part, that is true because of the way that the brain functions. And actually, once you stop going to Brighton and go to the other places more often, you'll find them more enjoyable. So some of that is biological, not psychological. But ultimately, giving up Brighton, giving up your addiction, is actually grief work. And people say, you know, I've tried giving up lots of times, and I will when I can find something to replace it. You won't find something as good as Brighton. Giving up your drug of choice, whatever that might be, you have to go through a process of bereavement. The good news, though, is that if you do stop going to Brighton, if you do stop this addiction, you can actually begin to really enjoy your primary relationship more, other forms of sexual activities. You can enjoy friendships. You can take up piano. You can enjoy piano. You can enjoy nature more. The rest of life begins to come alive so much more. And frankly, you won't die old and lonely, which is what tends to happen to people with sex addiction.
So how much of these addictions are caused by sort of baseline psychological problems that may be unresolved childhood material that we might not be conscious of? And how much is it that they've made pornography so tasty that, you know, even people who don't have baseline problems risk being pulled in because, you know, Brighton is just so flashy. It's got neon lights and they've now put a big wheel there and it's got so many temptations.
I'd love to know a statistic to that to give you, Andrew, but I don't have one. I think the pattern is beginning to change. It's really interestingly, and I think that's because pornography has become so much more available. But certainly, all of us need ways of chilling out, of numbing out. We've had a really, really busy day. You've had a stressful day. We're going to find ways of chilling out. There's nothing wrong with that. And it might be that you listen to your favourite podcast. It could be that you're reading a book. You're doing whatever it is. We find ways of just relaxing and chilling out. And if you're very worried or anxious about something, distracting yourself with something else is a good thing to do. So for many people, if they have a stressful life or if they are struggling, particularly with something like anxiety or depression, they might turn to pornography as a way of managing that uncomfortable and difficult emotion. So these underlying psychological issues absolutely can be the cause of the problem for many people who haven't been able to, for whatever reason, resolve that difficulty. For others, it's what I might call an opportunity-induced addiction. It's just because it was there. There's no warnings on the bottle. There's no immediate side effects. If you were to be drinking or taking drugs or gambling for 4 or 5 hours at a time, you'd know it. Your family would know it. People around you would know it. But you can watch porn for 4 or 5 hours, get up for work the next day, crack on. No one's going to know. No side effects, no come down. So for many people, the brain, that road to Brighton, can be developing and getting stronger without them even knowing that it was happening. That is often an opportunity-induced addiction. However, and this is the critical bit, I think, Andrew, when you recognise you do have a problem, when you recognise, oh my goodness, hold on, this is taking hours of my time. Actually, I haven't been out. I haven't seen friends for ages. Actually, I'm turning down real life sexual relationships because I'd rather look at porn. This is a problem. Some people are able to give up really quite easily. Not everyone needs a therapist. For some people, things like Pivotal Recovery, which is a self-help course, is more than enough. They can use something like that and actually understand the issue, understand the problem, get on with their life. Those that really struggle to get into recovery are those who also have all at the same time have developed other issues. One thing you might be very aware of is we know that during COVID, for example, all of us, or most of us, I include myself in this, turned to some rather bad habits. I drank more alcohol than normal in COVID. I definitely did. I ate more rubbish food. I definitely watched a heck of a lot more rubbish television. Those kind of addictive, compulsive type behaviours built up for many, many people during COVID, including pornography, including gambling, including all sorts of other, you know, bad habits as well. But for most of us, when we came out of COVID, we stopped. We were able to find the strength, to find the willpower, to find the ability, the support of others to stop those habits. But for others, they weren't able to, because there were other issues that were going on. So those psychological problems may be the cause, but they can often also be the maintaining factor.
So is there an acid test, a question you can ask yourself to work out if you have got a problem or an addiction to sex or pornography?
I think it's a bit more complicated than that. And unfortunately, that's also what feeds the controversy, because there are some people who self-diagnose where it isn't a problem. It's more of a moral issue. I watch pornography once a month and I feel I shouldn't because it's against my values. Therefore, I'm an addict, which clearly wouldn't work if we were talking about alcohol. There is on the Pivotal Recovery website, there is an Am I an Addict quiz. assessment, I should say, that sounds better, doesn't it? A self-assessment test on pivotalrecovery.org. And that actually, that test you'll find there also gives you a sense of how much of an addict I might be. Am I just at the mild end? Am I at the mild end where this is a bit of a problem and I need to get a grip? Or is this much more at the more serious end where perhaps I might need to seek some therapy as well? So it'll give you an indication of that. But in a nutshell, the question is this causing significant problems in my life? And in spite of that, I can't stop. Have I tried to stop and failed and it's causing problems in my life? That really is the ultimate question.
Or maybe because the image of porn addiction I had sort of unconsciously in my mind was a man who's married and doing it in privacy. But actually, there's quite a lot of single people who have porn addictions, and it's actually much easier to stay at home and pleasure yourself than actually go out and do that really rather rejectful experience of dating.
Indeed, absolutely. I think if it's damaging, we did a pilot study with Leeds University for Pivotal, because I'm a bit of a research nerd. I like to know if things work. And one of the questions that we asked in that was about the impact on relationships for people. So there was about, I can't remember, 120 people did the pilot study. And we asked about the impact on relationships. And I haven't got the stats in front of me, but certainly it was over 80% pretty much across the board saying that it had a negative impact on either maintaining a relationship or getting a relationship. So it's both ways. And absolutely, this is a problem that affects single people as well as those in relationships.
So let's look at the partners first, and then we'll look at the help for addicts. So, I mean, it's really shocking for a partner to discover the full depth of this. And the question they always say is, how could I not have known?
Absolutely. It is so destabilizing for partners. It's traumatic for partners, and that's not too big a word for many. And what we often say is it's the content of the discovery can be really hurtful and really upsetting, whether that's pornography, multiple affairs, multiple relationships, paying for sex, sex workers, whatever it might be. That can be really painful. But it's the secrecy that is actually traumatizing. It's the fact that the person that you may have been in a relationship for 5, 10, 20, 30 years, the person you thought you knew almost as well as yourself, has been leading a double life. And most of us think we're good judges of character. We think we know what's going on in our immediate, you know, world. And to discover you didn't, to discover that something has been hidden from you, not only makes you not trust the person, of course, but you don't trust yourself. You don't trust your own ability to know what's reality, to know what's truth. So there really is an existential trauma for many partners that they just did not know. And for partners, there can be the shock is enormous, but also feelings of shame as well. Shame on for their partner. Oh my goodness, what will people think of him or her once they know about this? But also shame that I didn't know. People will think I'm stupid. People will think, how did you not see the signs? And if I stay, if I decide to support my partner in recovery, what will people say about that? Will people say I'm an idiot, I'm stupid to stay? So partners often feel incredibly isolated as well. It's really tough.
And what I get is that they feel that there's something wrong with them at some level. Even if they tell themselves, no, this is stupid, they feel at some deep level that they were not enough for their partner.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess there's often a stereotype, as you say, that it's kind of the man in a marriage and he's not getting enough at home. And that's actually why he's doing this. And that is so often not the case at all. There are so many partners who have been sex starved for a long time because pornography or something, the sex life's gone off somewhere else. So absolutely they feel rejected. Why, I was here, I would have enjoyed a sexual relationship, and actually you preferred Brighton, you preferred that. And, what is wrong with me? And it's hard for partners to accept, and this is the reality, nothing compares to Brighton. Doesn't matter how gorgeous you are, you can't compete with the novelty. And that is what continues addiction, it is the novelty. The dopamine pathways continue to be stimulated by novelty and variety. We know that if you think about food, if I don't know what your favorite food is, Andrew, but if you were served it for breakfast, lunch and dinner 7 days a week, you'd go off it a bit. It would not be anywhere as nice as it used to be. We need variety in our diet in order to continue to stimulate that appetite. And pornography, if you like, is the ultimate buffet. So the appetite continues to be stimulated. So, yeah, for many partners, they feel very personally rejected as well.
So what advice would you give to somebody who is concerned about their partner's use, or they've discovered the full reality of the use and they realize that, you know, sex and porn addiction is part of, woven into their relationship? What do they do?
I'm currently writing Pivotal for Partners. So at some point I'll say, go to Pivotal for Partners. But unfortunately, I haven't finished writing it yet. But by the end of the summer, it should be done and completed. Identifying whether it really is addiction is important, because knowing whether or not you're with somebody because they have a problem they can recover from, they have developed a problem that can be overcome, or whether or not this is just a character fault, if you like. They're just a bad un. They're just a philanderer. That's what my father would say. They're a philanderer. It's important to know the difference. I guess the critical thing is, does your partner want to change? Do they accept and acknowledge that they have hurt you, that what they have been doing is not okay in a committed relationship, assuming that's what you're in? Do they recognize that, and do they want to change? Whether or not you then use the language of addiction or compulsion or whatever it is, perhaps is less important. Do they want to change? If they do want to change, then they need to work on that. You need to see the evidence that they want to change. Sometimes I hear stories, partners saying, oh, he said that. Oh, now I realize how much it's hurt you. I've just stopped. And that's pretty tough. It's like, hold on. If you can just stop just like that, why couldn't you have stopped before? And if there isn't something going on underneath, this is just about willpower, why could you not have done that before? And if you don't know what caused this, how do you possibly know that it won't happen again? So the person with the addiction, your partner, absolutely needs to do the work to get into recovery. And for you, really, the job is about regaining your sense of self again, learning about the problem, understanding what the problem is. So another book I don't think you mentioned was Sex Addiction, The Partner's Perspective. So buy the book, Sex Addiction, The Partner's Perspective. Understand what it is you're up against and actually begin to look after you. Your self-care is the most important thing. Regaining your sense of safety and stability, that you are okay. You can manage this. Partners often fly into, shall I stay, shall I go? Shall I stay, shall I go? Don't even think about that. I always say to partners, give yourself at least 6 months. There's no urgency because of the mistakes they've made. You're allowed to take your time to make that decision, particularly important, obviously, if there are children involved as well. So actually, don't even ask yourself that question for at least 6 months. Focus on getting your sense of safety and self-esteem back, focusing on what's important to you, focusing on what you do need from a relationship if you're going to stay in this relationship. And then when you're ready, if you're ready and you want to recommit to it, then it's going to be based on whether or not they have done the work of recovery. So it takes time. And I'm sure you've seen this as well, Andrew. Somebody walks into your office, or so often on Zoom now, isn't it? I need to know now, what do I do? Such an important question. But what you do right now is look after you.
And I think that's really good, that you really do need to give yourself time, because you could actually not be getting all the facts at this point. That's because, unfortunately, the information tends to come out in dribs and drabs. So, you know, it's not a good idea to make a decision too soon, because you don't actually know what you're dealing with. And I think you're really going to need support over this period. And it gives your partner time to work on themselves, so that maybe couple work is something that comes 6 months down the line, when you know exactly what you're dealing with, your partner has had a chance to start doing some work, and you're not in crisis. Because couple work, when you're in deep crisis, doesn't really start. It's sort of, most of the work is just sort of helping you from moment to moment, and that might be better done individually. So let's move on to the person who's recognized that they have got a problem. What is the work? How do you get to being sexual again without re-triggering and wanting to and starting fantasizing about your porn favorites?
Sorry, can I just go back and just say that what you said earlier about partners is so important. It's big with the addiction as well, but actually being in the support group with other partners. The Laurel Centre do lots and lots of online support groups for partners, and just breaking through that sense of isolation and being able to share with others in confidence is so, so important. So, yeah, support group for partners. Yeah, the person with the addiction, I think the first bit is kind of unpacking the problem. It's the what we call the psychoeducational piece of the work. So often when I first meet someone with a compulsive sexual behaviour, they don't know why it's happened. They don't know why they do it. Or they come up with kind of really not well thought through responses like, well, I was bored. It's just what I always do. And I think before you can really overcome a problem, you've got to understand what it is. If you don't know why your boiler isn't working, goodness knows why I came up with boiler in my head at this moment in time. I won't be able to follow on that, of course. I know nothing about plumbing. Too late. If there's a problem with your boiler, you need to know exactly what it is to know whether or not you're just going to switch it on and off again, or you need to get a plumber, or you need to get a replacement. You've got to do that bit of analysis first. So the first piece of work is really about understanding your problem from a biological and a psychological perspective. So the neuroscience piece we were talking about earlier, but also understanding what's going on for you psychologically. The next piece of work really is about understanding why you haven't overcome this problem in the past. It's pretty rare for me to meet someone who hasn't tried on a number of occasions. And finding out what faulty core beliefs they might have, which could be getting in the way of them recovering from this. So I use it in Pivotal, particularly we use what's known as the choice recovery model. And choice is an acrostic as well as kind of our philosophy for recovery. Because I think addiction takes away your choices. It takes away your ability to choose the person that you want to be and the life you want to lead. And actually recovery is about getting back into the driving seat of your life again. So the C stands for challenge core beliefs. What are my faulty core beliefs that might be telling me I won't be able to overcome this, or I need this, or this is the most important thing in my life? Really look at those, because otherwise they'll sabotage you in the future. The H is about having a vision. I'm so excited by the title of this podcast, The Meaningful Life, because I think we're both really big fans of positive psychology. Actually, what makes you happy? And actually, let's really look early on at what your life is going to be like without this addiction. Much easier to motivate people towards something than away from it. So we're not just going to talk about in Pivotal the harmful consequences, the impact on your partner, the negative thing. What about the future that you really want for yourself? So the H is have a vision. The O of choice is about overcoming the behaviours. And that's the real practical nuts and bolts stuff. That's the recognising your triggers, your emotional triggers, your environmental triggers, recognising your cognitive distortions, putting in place solid relapse prevention strategies. Really simple things like that. You absolutely need a porn blocker on every device that you have. But what are you going to, practical steps to stop you relapsing? The I is then about, of choice, is about identifying positive sexuality. What does it mean for you? And that is about getting in touch with your libido again, which often people that go to Brighton on a regular basis, people who chronically overeat, to go back to a food metaphor, have forgotten what it's like to be hungry. They don't know what it's like to be hungry anymore. And actually, let's get back in touch with hunger. Let's get back. And let's actually learn to enjoy some other food groups apart from pornography. There is human sexuality is amazing. There is so much out there. Actually, what can you do that is in line with your vision for the future, in line with your values, in line with your relationship, that actually you can enjoy? So identify positive sexuality. The second C in choice is connect with others. And this is all the attachment stuff that is real bread and butter to us, Andrew. Learning to connect with your partner, but learning to connect with friends. So often people with addictions have isolated. They have withdrawn more and more and more from friends and family and from the things yeah, that are important to them. So the C is about connection, and the final E of choice is establishing confident recovery. And in Pivotal, there are three sections to that. And one of the sections of the establishing confident recovery is developing a meaningful life. So it's actually absolutely follow this podcast series, because it's going to be brilliant for recovery. But developing a meaningful life. And for me, there's a big difference between recovery and sobriety. Sobriety is stopping. And when you just stop, there's a hole in your life and there's an emptiness. Recovery is building a meaningful life where this addiction, this behavior has no place anymore. It's not who I am. It's not what I do. It's not what I want. So developing a meaningful life establishing a meaningful life is the final E of the choice recovery model.
Right. Well, in a moment, we're going to be looking at a letter that, although not specifically on this topic, does actually illuminate it quite a lot. So that's coming up in just a moment.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Please follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material and other benefits.
You can participate in the program and send in a letter by going to andrewgmarshall.com/podcast. There's a section called Participate in the Program. I was sent a suggestion for a topic in the future about emotional detachment and emotional unavailability. And I thought that this was not just a great idea for a future podcast, which I will be arranging, but I thought it raised all sorts of interesting issues to raise with one of my witnesses on The Meaningful Life. And I chose Paula, and she was a bit surprised, but she actually realized this was at the core of her work. So here comes the letter. I recently found myself in a position where I had to emotionally detach from my best friend of 35 years. I found this approach actually improved the situation for both of us. I'm left with lots of questions. Can you help with them? How is emotional detachment different from emotional unavailability? How do we end up feeling emotionally responsible for others? Why is it difficult to emotionally detach from somebody we care about or love? How can having an objective point of view instead of being in the trenches with the person help you and them? When is the right time to emotionally detach and become more objective? Is it a skill that needs practice? When might emotional detachment not be a good idea? Can you rebuild a kind of relationship with that person where you still care as much but from a different perspective? And if you can, does this need to be agreed upon or does it happen organically? So, how do you respond to this one, Paula?
All of those questions all at once. It is a fascinating topic. The more I thought about it, the more I realised actually we work in this all the time, because people with an addiction have a tendency to be that they're not able to have emotional boundaries, which is another kind of word for emotional detachment. They're not able to take that objective stance. They get so caught up in what's going on around them, whether that's someone else's emotions or the emotion of the situation, that they're not able to be objective and rational and make good choices. And for partners, absolutely, partners can just get so engrossed in their partner's recovery that they lose themselves. I mean, I think the difference between emotional detachment and emotional unavailability to me is about consciousness. And I guess when we're talking about emotional, whether it's emotional, what's the opposite of emotional detachment? Emotional attachment? When you're engrossed in...
Could it be enmeshment?
Enmeshment, yes, I think that's right. In addiction, we might say codependence would be the word, but yeah, enmeshment or codependent, I think, is a very similar thing. I think when you're enmeshed with somebody, you're often not consciously aware. You lose your sense of self. When someone's emotionally unavailable, they're not aware that they are. But actually, when you become emotionally detached, it's a conscious decision and a conscious choice that comes from self-awareness. You're aware of what's happening. You're aware of what this person is saying or the emotion they're experiencing or whatever it might be. and you're able to just take that kind of step back, that conscious step back, and respond rather than react. And I think that's the real gift of emotional detachment, is that you're able to respond rather than just react, rather than getting caught up in what's going on in your own emotional state. You're able to actually respond from a more conscious perspective. Would you agree? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a slightly different way of putting the same stuff. So let me run my way of seeing it down. I mean, I think that when you're enmeshed and when you're too involved with somebody, you're going to be trying to rescue them. You know, they've got this terrible problem and you feel responsible in some way to actually rescuing them. The problem with that is it turns them into a victim. Yeah. And they also probably don't like you rescuing them, and they'll start acting out, either getting angry with you or you get angry with them because you're trying all this rescuing and it's not getting anywhere. So what you're trying to do when you're over-involved is rescue. Now, the problem is some people then detach to the point they're emotionally unavailable. So, you know, F you get on with it yourself. But there's somewhere between those two things, and I call that caring.
Yeah.
Now, if you can care, but you don't feel responsible for rescuing them. So the question is, what's the difference between rescuing and caring? Well, it's often down to a skill, and that skill is being able to listen. So, you know, they can tell you what's going on, but you don't have to feel responsible for sorting it out. You can hear about the fact they're feeling down. You know, it's not your responsibility to be the entertainment officer.
I like the, sometimes we talk about rescuing, yeah, and you're absolutely right, partners can end up doing that. And actually, sometimes the person with the addiction, they are rescuers. In every other area of life, they're rescuing others, constantly looking after, rescuing other people. In their addiction is where they find time for themselves. That is just for me. And the secrecy of it is actually really important because it makes it feel even more like a place where they have some boundaries. I think another way to think of it, of caring, is if you think about the difference between a rescuer and a coach. So someone that's a coach, if you go in to think of sporting again, someone who's a coach doesn't say, I can see you're tired, I can see you're exhausted, I'll run the race for you. What a coach says is, I can see you're tired, I can see you're exhausted. So they have the empathy, they're listening, they listen to the issues, they listen to the problem. But I believe you can do it. I believe that actually you can manage this. So coaching is really quite different from rescuing. Coaching doesn't do it for the other person, but actually gives them a little bit of nudge, a little bit of support. Maybe that's where the caring is.
So let's go down to the last question again. Can you rebuild a new kind of relationship with that person where you still care as much from a different perspective? I think we've answered that one just now. And if you can, does that need to be agreed upon or does it happen organically? So I think that's really interesting. Can you agree on this or have you just got to put it into action?
I guess ideally it would be agreed upon, but often... And it's going to, I'm so curious about the person that wrote this letter, and I would love to know more about the ways in which it improved the situation for both of them. I was really curious about that. And 35 years is a long, long friendship, isn't it? Long relationship. I think if you know the person fairly well and they have fairly good self-awareness, good insight, then a conversation about the roles that you found yourself in and how does this feel and how can we renegotiate and how can we talk about the boundaries that are appropriate for us and what's going to work for you and what I feel will work for me and tell me how I can support you, how we, you know, to be collaborative would be great. That would be the ideal. But that's not always possible. But in my experience, if you do step back from rescuing, if you do step back from that kind of codependency enmesh position and hold your boundaries over time, I think the other person does begin to change. But I think you're probably going to experience more kickback because we're creatures of habit. We are very used to reacting and responding to people in the way we always expect that they will. I find it interesting sometimes talking to siblings. Siblings will sometimes treat each other like, I know what you're like. You did this to me when you were 8. And it's like, I'm 58. I'm not like that. I've changed. And we often don't allow time for people to change, but people do change and relationships change. And if you change your position, over time, I believe the other person will as well, or they'll exit the relationship, unfortunately. But over time, so I think it can happen organically. There's going to be some kickback.
Yeah, but I think in general, focus on yourself and find out why you tend to be emotionally over-involved rather than spending your time focusing on your friend. Because, and this is the incredibly true in this area, it's really difficult to change other people. It's not quite so difficult to change ourselves. So let's not aim for the moon and the stars. Let's sort out this planet first.
Yeah. No, that's so true, isn't it? If you change, they will probably begin to change with you. But you need to make sure you're doing it for the right reasons, and recognizing where it comes from definitely makes it easier to change.
So I hope that's been helpful for you. And I will be doing a program on this topic because I think emotional detachment is a really interesting topic. I've now just got to find somebody to talk to me about it. So, Paula, we're heading towards the end of the main podcast at the moment. The conversation continues. If you would like to find out more, we're going to be talking about finding a new life after addiction. So how to fill the hole, which I think is a really interesting topic. I hope you can join us for that. But before we end, let me ask you, as a witness on The Meaningful Life, what makes your life meaningful?
It's another one of those questions, isn't it? It's hard to kind of boil down. But so I'm going to have the three things that came straight to my mind when I read the question. Family. I'm delighted to be a grandmother now. Would you believe, Andrew? I know you're looking at me thinking that's not humanly possible. But I now have an 18-month-old grandson, and he is an absolute delight. And my other daughter got married just a few weeks ago, which was absolutely wonderful. So family, really, really important to me. Work is really important. And I was thinking about that and thinking, gosh, yeah, my work is really important. Why is it? And I think it's because it is... For me, there is something about service which is really important, and I get a lot out of caring for others. I get a lot out of giving and doing, you know, getting Pivotal off the ground as a not-for-profit was something I've wanted to do for years and years and years, and I've been so excited about that and the potential future for it. And it is about trying to serve others in crisis, and I think that is something that's really important to me. And the final bit would be nature. I moved down to Dorset since we last met. You used to live in the Midlands, but during lockdown moved down to Dorset, and I'm now just about 20 minutes from the sea and the cliff tops, and it's just beautiful. So nature, and I think it helps give a perspective to life as well.
And as we should have said earlier, there are other seaside towns beyond Brighton, and they offer just as many pleasures, like cliff walks and sandy coves. So if you'd like to find out more about New Life After Addiction, you can hear that on the bonus material. You can subscribe directly via Apple or Spotify. And if you want to become a supporter of The Meaningful Life and unlock the bonus material this way, here are the details.
You've been listening to The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. You can follow Andrew on Twitter, like him on Facebook, and please leave a review wherever you consume your podcasts. Making, editing, and distributing The Meaningful Life comes with substantial costs, and we'd like to ask for your help. Visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material for every program, send in a letter to be discussed by Andrew and his guests, and join a community of other people seeking to make their life meaningful. At the gold level, you get even more benefits. Production of The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall is by Michael Dooney. Social media by Madeleine Healy. Sound engineering and theme tune by Sebastian de la Luz Mendoza. And I'm Susie Colick. Please tell your friends and spread the word. Thank you.